You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about the music coming out of Wisconsin's lumber camps in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
First, as antibiotic resistance becomes an increasing problem, the hunt for new antibiotics and other disease-fighting agents is on the rise. Among the top places to look, the world of fungi.
Now, new research from UW-Madison, Northwestern University, and the biotech company Intact Genomics is giving scientists a faster way to discover new compounds from molds.
The new technology is called FAC-MS. Recently, it helped to identify 17 new natural products from three diverse fungal species, a huge success rate compared with other methods.
Nancy Keller joins us now. She's a professor of medical microbiology and immunology and bacteriology at UW-Madison and is a part of the team working on this new technology. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, Nancy, first of all, why are fungi such a great place to look for new chemicals, new disease-fighting compounds?
They're good organisms to look at because it's part of their lifestyle. It's sort of what they do. You know how these days people say, oh, why does the dog bark? And they say, because that's what they do. Well, why do fungi make these compounds? It's what they do to protect themselves. So I think the easiest way to look at it is fungi live in a mix with all sorts of other microorganisms, other fungi, bacteria, insects, parasites, and they have to find a way to secure their niche. So they have evolved a lot of chemicals that are useful in protecting themselves from these other organisms or even killing the other organisms.
I know we're at the scouting stage now, but what kind of potential do researchers like you see in fungi as a source for potential new disease-fighting agents?
Vast. It's huge. If you look at the genome of the types of fungi that make these molecules, you can see that they might have upwards to even 70 different genetic units, each of which that could possibly make a new chemical that could be useful in some sort of therapy or antimicrobial use.
And I want to get our term straight a little bit here. What are fungi? Are they kind of the same thing as molds, for instance?
Yeah, molds are a type of fungus. I think molds refer to those fungi that we see growing on our food or showers. It's just the, I'd say, the public term for a fungus that grows sort of in a tubular branching fashion and then produces a lot of spores. And to us, if you see it growing, let's say, on your orange, it just looks like fuzzy growth.
And am I wrong, just thinking about the potential here, didn't penicillin come from a kind of mold?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that illustrates what I was saying in the very beginning when you started asking me why are fungi such a great place. So penicillin was accidentally found by Alexander Fleming, oh boy, about 100 years ago. Dr. Fleming was growing bacteria, looking for some useful qualities from bacteria, and this fungus, Penicillium, accidentally contaminated one of his bacterial plates, and he saw this big zone of inhibition where the fungus was killing the bacteria, and that zone of inhibition was the chemical penicillin.
And as I understand it, there have been some pretty significant challenges, though, in working with fungi and trying to get at some of these new chemicals and maybe disease-fighting compounds. For instance, you know, it's possible to rediscover penicillin, spend a lot of time, and at the end of the day, you've got penicillin again. So can you tell us about some of the challenges here?
Well, there's several challenges. One of them is we don't know what turns on these genetic units that make a molecule. So that's a problem. Sometimes we don't know what genes are inside the fungus, although we're starting to find that pretty easily now because it's getting cheaper and easier to sequence the genome. Another problem is even if we can find a fungus and we're able to sequence and see the genes, it's not necessarily easy to work with that particular fungus. So some fungi are amenable to technologies that will allow us to get to these chemicals readily, and others, it's very difficult to work with fungi, certain fungi.
Talking to Nancy Keller from the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison about the hunt for potential new medications, useful compounds from the world of fungus. And there's new technology, Nancy, and I want to get into that. FAC-MS, that's how I'm reading it. I don't know if there's a clever shorthand way to say it. What is it, and how is it helping?
Sure. We call it FAC, mass spec. FAC stands for Fungal Artificial Chromosome. And MS is mass spectrometry. What really this technology is that we developed, I and my collaborators, is we found a way to place those genetic units that produce these chemicals that we want. We've been able to place them in a vector that can be easily put in a model fungus that's easy to work with. And so these FACs, or fungal artificial chromosomes, we put into a fungus that's easy to work with. This fungus is called Aspergillus nigellans. And then we can grow up Aspergillus nigellans that has these FACs, which will contain the DNA units from other fungi. And we grow it up, and we then take the extracts of that fungus and analyze it using mass spectrometry to identify new compounds.
And this new method, this is so far, it's a lot faster. How come?
Oh, it's much faster because, okay, we're able to clone all of the genetic units within one single fungus and screen them very rapidly. So, for instance, maybe a fungus might have might have about 50 genetic units, each one of them making a specific chemical. Traditionally, to try to find a chemical from one of those units, you could only work at one unit at a time. So if you have a fungus that has 50 units, it might take you 1 year for each unit. So there we go, 50 years. This FAC-MS technology allows us to gather the information of all 50 units at one time and make a library of those 50 units and then start looking at the products of those 50 units in a short time frame. So maybe scan through those 50 units in 1 year as compared to looking at a single unit in 1 year.
And then as you scan those units more quickly and you're finding a bunch of these connections here, what would be next? To take a substance you find in the genetic makeup of it and start researching it for potential medical uses?
Yes, that's one of them. We're interested in examining these compounds for antimicrobial properties. Just as you said, I think in the very beginning of our presentation here, we're seeing a lot of bacteria and some pathogenic fungi that are gaining resistance to the drugs we use to try to control them. So we're very interested in finding new chemicals that can control the diseases caused by these microbes. Other examples are finding chemicals that will control cancer development.
Some good prospects on the horizon. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Nancy Keller is a professor of medical microbiology at UW-Madison. She worked with Northwestern University and the biotech company Intact Genomics to develop faster technology to find potentially disease-fighting chemicals from the world of fungus. Lumber camps were a big part of Wisconsin's culture in the 19th and early 20th centuries, even before Wisconsin became a state. Lumber isn't the only thing that came out of Wisconsin's logging camps. Music was a big part of that culture, too.
Jim Leary joins us now to talk about the role of music in lumber camps. He's Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison and co-director of a three-year National Endowment for the Humanities project, Local Centers, Global Sounds. That's a joint venture of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures and the Mills Music Library. He's the editor of the book, Pinery Boys, Songs and Song Catching in the Lumberjack Era. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Very glad to be here.
Well, tell us about the music scene in Wisconsin's lumber camps back in the day.
Oh, man, it was pretty wild and woolly. They were a mixture of people from a lot of different places, from the Canadian Maritimes, from the state of Maine, kind of Anglo-American background, but there were a lot of Irish, some of whom came down through Canada. There were Ojibwas, Chippewas, Menominee, mixed you know, French Indian people, French Canadians, but then lots of Scandinavians, also Polish people, Germans, Belgians, you name it. The northern half of Wisconsin was the pinery, and people from all those backgrounds went into the woods oftentimes.
So that must mean the music there was not just one kind of music, but you must have had a whole lot of different traditions kind of active up there.
There was a lot that went on. Back in those days, of course, if you wanted music and song, you had to do it yourself. And a lot of peoples had customs of getting together in the wintertime when crops were done and you'd try to socialize. And, of course, the work in the lumber camps had to be done in the winter because you had to move the big timber over the frozen ground. And so people would go into the woods, mostly men and teenage boys, and they'd be there for a couple of months, would work 6 days a week, but Saturday night they'd have time for some fun. And so there was an expectation, that you'd chip in. Some people were better than others, but some could play a tune on a fiddle or sing a song or dance a jig or do a trick or tell a story. So people did that.
And this is partly a story about the songs and the singers, but it's also about the song catchers. And you've edited this volume by Franz Rickaby, who collected a lot of these lumber songs.
Yeah, Franz Rickaby was born in Rogers, Arkansas. He was a fairly young man when he died, only in his mid-30s. He died in 1925. But in the late teens and early 20s, he decided to be an adventurer and to kind of hike and travel around through the upper Midwest, especially northern lower Michigan, the UP, northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota, in search of lumber camp songs. And he would play his fiddle sometimes to entice people. He got help from different folks along the way. But he was really part of a wave of people who were interested mostly in English language narrative folk songs that were a heritage from England and Scotland, to some extent Ireland. And he was looking for those, and he was inspired in part by John Lomax, Alan Lomax's father, who in 1910 had published a book called Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads. And Rickaby wanted to find out what the lumber camp equivalent of that might be. And he found lots of amazing songs and singers.
I don't want to wait any longer to listen to some music here. This is one called Shantman.
Shantyman.
There's I thought there was a missing Y. All right, let's listen to Shantyman. Here it is.
All you jolly fellows, come listen to my song. It's all about the Pinery Boys and how they get along. They're the jolliest lot of fellows, so merrily and fine. They will spend their pleasant winter months in cutting down the pine.
Some taste of the song Shantyman there. Tell us about that one.
Well, that's a song that's gotten around a lot in Canada and the United States. It's kind of a chronicle of what goes on in the woods during the year and what happens to the teamsters and the sawyers and the swampers and what happens later in the log drives. And the singer, a very remarkable person, Emery Denoyer, French-Canadian background, around Merrill in the late 19th century. He was injured and blinded, and but had a great ear and was a good singer. And he picked up out in the Rhineland area a lot of these songs. And with help from a brother, they would trudge around to lumber camps in the Rhinelander area, and they later would take the train and go farther afield, even into Minnesota. And he would sing and entertain in the lumber camps, and then he picked up other songs there as well.
That was a very cheery song. This is a guy who had been injured and blinded. I'm sure he wasn't the only one. This was dangerous work, probably lonely, cold, because it's the middle of the northern Wisconsin winter.
Right.
Are all the songs about the merits and happy times of pine lumbering?
Well, no. You know, there are songs about people being beheaded in log drives by, you know, crashing timbers or having large limbs fall on them, or miserable conditions. There are some fairly raunchy ones complaining about bad food in the lumber camps, or slave driving bosses work all day, no sugar in your tea when you're working on the weight boys roll away, and you know, that sort of thing. So plenty of complaint.
And so that one was a cappella, just one voice singing kind of a narrative picture story song, I guess you could call it. Did you ever get kind of bigger ensembles going, harmonies, that kind of thing?
Well, not much as far as we know. You know, that whole Monty Python, I'm a lumberjack, with people singing with choruses and dancing around, and they're all named
Wait,
Bruce.
That didn't really happen?
No, not exactly. So a lot of the, yeah, a lot of the singing was a cappella. And Denoyer, even though he was French-Canadian, sang in what was very much an Irish style, you know, a little higher pitch than a normal voice, kind of in that tenor vein, and a slow tempo to it, and some ornamentation in the singing. And he often used that ending of speaking the last line, just saying it, shifting the gears. And that was a fairly dominant style in the lumber camps.
Talking to Jim Leary, looking at the music of Wisconsin's lumber camps in the 19th century into the 20th century a little bit. A new book, he's edited a reissue, Pinery Boys, Songs and Song Catching in the Lumberjack Era. Let's give we've got another sample from the book. We'll give a listen.
In 1871, to swamp for a gold devil we begun. 'Twas on the banks of the Eau Claire, we landed there when the ground was bare. Yoo!
An enthusiastic rendition there.
Yeah, that's 1871, to swamp with a go devil we begun, and that's like hauling out a log out to the tote road with a travois, or a kind of a log improvised sleigh made out of a forked log.
So a literal description of the work at hand.
Yeah.
What is the thumping clicking in the background?
That was Ray Calkins whacking with a peavey that's kind of a cant hook that's kind of a log wrench for manipulating.
So it's logs. Actually, you know, stuff you'd use to cut down trees.
Once they're cut and cut into lengths, you use it to kind of maneuver them around.
So it's part of the equipment used in the craft
And then a part of the book, the reissue here, Franz Rickaby, the original song catcher, I understand his granddaughter wrote a big introduction to it.
A fortuitous thing. I'd been interested in Rickaby's book, Ballads and Songs of the Shanty Boys, that came out in 26. It had been out of print and wanted to do a new edition. And as I was thinking of that, I was very lucky through a mutual friend to meet Gretchen Dykstra, at least from afar. We've never met in person, but she's Rickaby's granddaughter, and she was pursuing the grandfather she never met, and had access, of course, not only to family stories, but photographs and letters. And then she kind of retraced his steps and did a magnificent job of revealing the life of this person about whom very little was known. And then I added a little bit at the back in the Mills Music Library. We have a lot of unpublished songs from the Upper Midwest by Rickaby, and I was able to add those and annotate them. So it's kind of a new packaging of old stuff, but with this great bio.
So did she feel that she did got get to know her grandfather through this work that she had done, and maybe from stuff that you added too.
Yes, she did, and she writes about that in a very vivid and touching way. So I'll leave that as a surprise for interested readers.
Now, in the book, it's not just the words of these songs, but Rickaby collected the melodies, and there's the musical notation. So if the musically inclined at home wanted to sing these lumberjack songs, they could do that with a piano and guitar.
Absolutely, yes. And the two songs we've heard were songs, different versions of the same stuff that's in the book that were made in field recordings in the 30s and 40s.
Jim, are any of these songs, I mean, there's still a lumber industry in Northern Wisconsin. It's not what it was, but are any of these songs still alive and kicking today?
Well, there's a younger guy, Brian Miller, who grew up in Bemidji, Minnesota. He lives in the Twin Cities now. He's played a lot of Irish music, and he has done two great CDs of lumber camp songs from Wisconsin and Minnesota, mostly a lot of them with Irish melodies and instrumental music. So they're younger people who are picking up on this stuff.
We're going to go out, Jim, with a song called Lost Jimmy Whalen. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, this is in northern Ontario. There was a guy who was killed on a log drive, and this is a story about his sweetheart calling up his spirit from the dead. Sung by Robert Walker from Crandon.
As slowly and sadly I strayed by the river, hey, watching the sunbeams as evening drew nigh, as onward I rambled, I spied.
And Jim, I want to thank you so much for joining us again today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. He's the editor of Pinery Boy, Songs and Song Catching in the Lumberjack Era, and he joined us to talk about the role of music and lumber camps in Wisconsin.
There's more to come on Central Time. We'll go out with more of Lost Jimmy Whalen. This is the Ideas Network.
Jimmy said she, won't you come to my arm and give me sweet kisses that oft times you've done. You promised you'd meet me this evening, my darling. Oh, come, dearest Jimmy, love, come from your grave. Slowly there rose from...
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on Snap Judgment. This week, best-selling author Jamaica Kincaid is sent to live with her aunt after the birth of her little brother. And a problem gambler with a destructive streak tells himself he can beat the odds just one last time. Those stories and more tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, going to work and paying the bills are part of life. We pay for shelter, we pay for food and insurance, and a lot of stuff in between. But a new study shows that more and more Americans are finding it difficult for their incomes to keep pace with their expenses.
The new study found that half of Americans surveyed said that their expenses are either equal to or greater than their income. And our next guest says this issue is more complicated than people either living beyond their means or needing to make more money.
Jennifer Tesher joins us now. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Financial Services Innovation, which conducted the survey. And the group's mission is to improve the financial health of Americans. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's go over this finding again. It's significant, takes a little bit to sink in, but it sounds like about half of Americans have finances where the expenses outstrip the income.
Yeah, I know. For those of us who are fortunate to have abundance, right, to have what we need to live comfortably, it can seem jarring that the statistic is that high, but it's very consistent with research that we've been doing for the last several years now that shows that on average about half of Americans are financially challenged in some way.
And so when you look at younger people, to point this out, the numbers get even worse, right?
That's right. Now, some of that is to be expected. Younger people are just beginning their work journey. They're just beginning to earn hopefully significant money, more than just the odd job here and there. But they are also facing far greater challenges than previous generations were, particularly as it relates to student debt. When we think about the student debt crisis, we tend to think about the sheer amount of debt owed and how that can keep someone from being in a position of, say, buying a home or taking advantage of other opportunities in the future. But we rarely stop to consider the impact that that has on someone's monthly cash flow and just how much of their monthly inflows are being taken up by student loan repayments or other debt payments.
And looking at, you know, the broad demographics again, one issue you look at is volatility, that there's not, it doesn't seem to be a steady pace for the income each month the same, but one month, you know, you might have a lot more, another month quite a bit less, and that can be hard for families to handle.
That's right. We found in our survey that 38% of those who spend more than their income also have volatile income. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, we all tend to think, oh, they must be overspending. And I'm sure that it's certainly true for some percentage of people. But there are many other factors causing those volatile incomes. Think about, for instance, real-time or just-in-time scheduling, where if you work in an hourly job, your employer every week may be adjusting the hours that you are going to get for work that week. And you just don't know in advance. That's a really big factor. Another is that people are often working now multiple jobs, and usually that second or third job may not be as reliable. We also have more folks who are generating income from the gig economy. And while the number of people who are generating the majority of their income from gig work is still relatively small as a percentage of the overall workforce, increasingly, people are trying to supplement their incomes with money from the gig economy, and that also makes for spotty and volatile incomes.
Right. There's been a lot of talk about what's been called the gig economy lately. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how that might paint in this picture?
Sure. You know, the rise of what people call the gig economy or the 1099 economy really came out of the birth of companies like Airbnb and Uber. We used to call it the sharing economy. Jobs where you're not actually an employee, generally speaking, of the company, but you're a contract worker who is essentially filling orders, whether it's picking someone up in your car or giving them a place to sleep or shopping for and delivering their groceries. On the one hand, these kinds of jobs create tremendous flexibility for people, and a lot of people seem to like it. It also enables people to earn some extra money on the side. But increasingly, people are either choosing this work or are forced to take this kind of work really as their primary source of income. And I think it's anyone's guess how significant a part of the workforce this part of the economy will become, but the jury is definitely out on whether this is a net positive or a net negative to workers.
We're talking to Jennifer Tesher right now. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Financial Services Innovation. And they recently conducted a study looking at income and expenses for Americans, found that almost half of Americans had expenses that were greater than the amount of income that they were taking in each month. And Jennifer, your organization, your conclusion here is that it isn't that Americans need to kind of rein in the spending and be more disciplined. I mean, there, as you said, there's probably some of that, but you think there's something bigger, something structural going on.
I think that's right. You know, wages have been flat for decades now, a couple decades, while living expenses are steadily increasing. So think about healthcare, which is dominating the news these days, and just how much healthcare costs have grown in the last couple decades. Think about housing costs, and in particular, rental costs. People are spending ever-increasing shares of their income, 50, 60, 70% of their income, just on a place to sleep every night. That's not a nice-to-have. That's a must-have. And then there's the student debt issue that we talked about earlier and other kinds of debt payments you know, right after the financial crisis and the Great Recession, we saw also a great deleveraging, if you will, a lot of folks either paying down their debt or filing for bankruptcy or having their debt forgiven. But in the last couple of years, we've started to see debt levels creep up again. And I think, unfortunately, in this country, people have been trying to solve an income problem with debt, and that never ends well.
How does this affect a family who may be trying to survive, keep their head afloat, or to move to a place maybe where they are more solvent and they can look at bigger goals when they have, say, a big bill come in, like a $2,000 medical bill, or they need a new car suddenly? How does that affect their financial stability?
That's a great question. And I think I really like you pointing out this issue of insolvency, because I think the issue is whether people are illiquid or insolvent, because those are quite different matters. And many of the people we're talking about, particularly those who face significant volatility in their incomes, are really just illiquid. They have a cash flow problem. But financial products and services that exist out there weren't really designed for people who are living close to the edge, right? Your checking account assumes that you have a cushion. These are folks who don't really have a cushion. And so when you don't have a cushion and that emergency comes up or that opportunity comes up, you end up having to either forego it or turn to debt products, which can be perfectly good if you can afford to repay them. But if you don't have a lot of cushion, you may end up taking out a loan with a much longer term or a higher interest rate in order to be able to afford the monthly payments. So you're going to end up paying more in interest costs over the course of time. It's really another form of inequality in a way. We tend to think about people's income or assets, but access to tools that help you manage your cash flow, particularly when you're cash strapped, is a real have-not kind of situation for Americans.
Do you think this reality, as depicted in the study and seen there in the lives of families, has been something that's been processed, for instance, by Washington and identified as a problem, or is it still something that we're struggling to put a finger on?
I kind of hoped that last year, in the run-up to the election and the result of the election itself, helped form a wake-up call to Washington about the real financial lives of Americans. It certainly reminded people that rural Americans in particular are challenged and really deserve attention. But unfortunately, I haven't seen much change. I haven't even seen a whole heck of a lot of new policy suggestions based on this idea of increasing volatility. And, you know, to be clear, this isn't just a poor person's problem. This is a problem that is across the board. The Brookings Institution found that over the last several decades, income volatility has increased 30%. So a lot of us are facing this issue. And just to put a finer point on it, my colleagues just published a book a couple of months ago called The Financial Diaries. And in that study, we followed 235 families for a year, and we documented every dollar that flowed in and out of their households and the decisions behind those flows. And the most important finding from that research was that, on average, families spend 5 months out of the year with income greater or less than the average of 25%. So for 5 months out of the year, people are either facing an income spike or an income dip of as much as 25%. So that's not just a little blip. That's a very significant swing in one's income, and it makes it very difficult to plan and to sort of engage in financial behaviors that are framed around the long term as opposed to how am I going to get through the week. You know, in this country, we tend to think about people's annual incomes or their average incomes, but no one lives on the average and no one lives in the year. They live day to day, week to week, and that's where people are getting caught.
Talking with Jennifer Tesher right now. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Financial Services Innovation. They recently conducted a study looking at income and expenses for Americans.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the many Americans having a difficult time with incomes and expenses? Do you experience this income volatility our guest was talking about? You make more one month, less the next month, and you may not know which the next month's going to be. What questions do you have about financial health in America? What are some of the roadblocks you see? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now about the financial health of Americans with Jennifer Tesher. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Financial Services Innovation. They recently conducted a study looking at income versus expenses, found that a majority of Americans are having a difficult time with their finances. They have more expenses than they have money.
Is that you? You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What roadblocks are out there for you in maintaining financial health? Is it student loans for you? Is it living expenses? Is it unpredictable expenses that rise from week to week, month to month? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go to our first caller. We've got Matt on the line in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm an architect in Milwaukee, and I also earn side income as a real estate broker. My architect income doesn't vary week to week, but expenses do. Even though I make a salary, it's still hard to make ends meet. I'm the head of household, and my wife doesn't have a job. So it's the reason for the increase in prices is the Federal Reserve. The central bank has caused the dollar to decrease in value like 99% since it was started in 1913.
Matt, thank you for that call. And focusing on the first part of what Matt had to say, Jennifer, saying he's got a salary job, he's an architect, he's got another job. On top of that is a real estate broker, and he says his expenses are ping-ponging around a bit, and that's a reality for a lot of people.
But I think he makes an excellent point there. It's not just that income is volatile. So are expenses. I think, again, personal finance historically has suggested to us that the vast majority of our expenses are fixed and that the rest of it is where we have some control. But our financial diaries book and study that I described a few minutes ago suggests exactly what the caller did, that expenses are as volatile as income. And the problem is that when you have an income spike or dip, you don't know whether your expenses are also spiking or dipping, and often there's a mismatch between the two. Sometimes you're lucky enough to have an income spike just at the right time when you also have an expense that you didn't know was coming, but often it's the opposite, and so that's a real challenge.
Another thing Matt's call got at, I just want to talk about very quickly before we move on to our next caller, because we have a lot of folks waiting, but you know, he said he's an architect, and I think for a lot of people that's an occupation with a lot of prestige, and you don't imagine someone who's an architect having financial instability problems.
That's right. You know, one of the other challenges here is that money is such a taboo topic. This is not something that we're often comfortable talking about, and so we don't often realize that other people in our lives may be experiencing these problems. It might be a family member. It might be a colleague at work. It might be the person caring for your children, the receptionist in your office. It might be someone you're doing business with. And so it's one of the reasons why my organization earlier this week organized for the second year in a row Fin Health Matters Day. We feel like it's really important to have a national dialogue about money. We often talk about economic challenges, but we don't talk enough about financial challenges. And I think that one of the ways to relieve some of the stress is to know that there are other people out there facing the same issue.
Well, Matt, thank you for the call. And we go next to Megan in Appleton. Megan, hi.
Hi. I am so glad you guys are talking about this. My boyfriend and I just started having this conversation last night as we're kind of newly graduated. And, he's making a lot more than I am, but I'm kind of that mid-tier range of paycheck, and I just kind of wanted to talk about how, you know, even being in a stable income, it is so hard when we have, you know, things to prepare for. When we have, like, a bill come up, like a doctor's bill or something, it's hard for us to kind of recuperate when we have, like, oh, my gosh, it's $200 plus on top of rent and, you know, just making livable groceries and stuff like that. And preparing myself to turn 26 and have kind of that, you know, insurance is coming my way and think, oh, my gosh, this is going to be a fixed expense pretty soon. Can I live like this? When just right now, you know, a few $100 spike here and there is really causing some damage in our planning to, you know, get married or anything like that. It's really frustrating.
Megan, thank you so much for sharing all that. I really appreciate all of your, all of the thoughts you had there. And Jennifer, Megan gets at something there about how, you know, you, 1 month you have a bill and you're already kind of on a shoestring and you're supposed to be smart and put a little bit aside, but then that $200 medical bill comes up and there goes that, you know, $200 that you put aside last month, or maybe you start in the hole. How do people bounce back from stuff like that, like Megan?
Yeah, really appreciate you sharing, Megan, and good for you for at the age of 25 taking these issues so seriously and really starting to think about them. I definitely think that's half the battle. You know, I would never say that technology in and of itself can solve these problems, but I do think there are a growing number of technology tools, financial technology tools, that can make it easier for people to manage and optimize when and how they are paid, when and how they pay their bills, when and how they might find an opportunity to set aside some money. So as an example, you know, we all know we're supposed to save, right? But boy, how do we make that happen? It feels so difficult. Well, there's a company called Digit. It's an app, and you connect it to your checking account, and it uses an algorithm to regularly monitor your cash flow. And every day or two, it looks for small sums of money, tiny sums, really, that it could remove from your checking account and sweep into your savings account without it causing you a cash flow problem, without you even knowing about it. They have helped a tremendous number of consumers save well over $250 million in aggregate, $5 to $30 at a time. So it's a little bit like finding that loose change in the couch, but who wants to go to the bank to deposit it? So increasingly, tools like Digit can make it a little bit easier to set it and forget it, and to start building even just a little financial cushion, even just a couple of $100s can make a really big deal.
Megan, thanks a lot, and good luck to you. And Jennifer, in our last 30 seconds here, you said financial tools are not going to solve the problems. What will?
Well, I think that we need to have a policy conversation in this country. We need to deal with some of the structural challenges that I mentioned, both about wages and income, about the social safety net, about the cost of health care. You know, we've got to get real about these issues, because this isn't just a niche problem. This is the majority of Americans.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Tesher is the president and CEO of the Center for Financial Services Innovation, joining us today to talk about their group's new study finding that about half of Americans don't have enough income coming in to meet their expenses.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the perceived gap, sometimes conflict, between Wisconsin's biggest cities and the rest of the state, and how it could shape the upcoming governor's race.
A guest says partisan rancor may run deep, but there are still ways for Congress to come together to fight political violence.
And we'll check in on the biggest stories out of Wisconsin this week in our state news roundup. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday.
That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.